Here at the ABC, we were very lucky to have a woman called Stella Young work with us for a period of time. She died in 2014, way too young, but we can still read her work and watch her online, telling some uncomfortable and necessary truths about the assumptions that the able-bodied sometimes project onto people with disabilities. She was cheeky, she was funny, she had a really good BS detector, and she wanted to see things change. And a new anthology reminds me strongly of all that. It's called Growing Up Disabled in Australia. It's edited by Carly Findlay, and Olivia Musket is one of the contributors. Olivia, Carly, welcome to Life Matters.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Olivia Musket, you used the letter writing format for your piece addressing people in your life and animals and strangers. Why did you choose letters? Why did they help you say what you particularly wanted to say?
I mean, the letter idea was born out of a complete accident. I actually used it on the suggestion of a friend as a sort of a brainstorming, idea-generating tool. But as I did it, I thought, actually, wow, this is a great way for me to explore several different ideas and come at my disability and my relationship to it from several different angles and address people directly and sort of talk directly to them rather than, say, to an audience or a reader. But then, obviously, that speaks to the reader through that direct sort of addressing of whoever it is I happen to be talking to in any particular letter.
Including your guide dog.
Yeah.
it's a beautiful letter. But tell us why you resisted having a guide dog for quite a long time.
It's a little bit complicated. Not really. I'm just not an animal person. And I thought I was comfortable using a good old cane that you can just fold up at the end of the day and put in the corner and not have to worry about feeding or playing or patting. And I made the choice at the right time to decide, actually, I'm not as comfortable and independent as I would like to be. I'm not comfortable going somewhere, you know, I've never been before on my own. And that was partly to do with my own confidence and partly to do with the way I knew people reacted to me as a cane user. And I made the choice at the right time to get a guide dog. It wouldn't have worked earlier, I think, just because of the intensity of guide dog training and having a guide dog and how different it is to using a cane. It's a very different form of mobility. And
you talk, Olivia, about the reactions that you get. Quite a few of your letters are very bluntly directed at total strangers who just invade your personal space or come up and comment on your life. How hard is it to have to be reclaiming that personal space all the time?
It's exhausting. That's the best way to describe it, I think. It just makes being out and about really tiring and having to, you know, tell people to back off and sometimes having to be that blunt with people in person, because that's, you know, that's not who I generally think of myself as, someone who tells people to back off, get off, don't touch me. But just that constant onslaught of people sort of invading my space and my life makes me into that person, to the point where if I have a day where I'm on, you know, doing whatever I have to do on public transport, going to work, wherever, and I get home and I go, oh, wow, no one, you know, did anything to make me angry today, where that's sort of an anomaly. And that's sort of a depressing thought.
Yeah. Oh, bonus, I was not enraged today.
Yeah.
Carly Findlay, there's this incredible diversity in the submissions in the book, and I think you had to choose between over 360 submissions just to kind of wrestle it down. But one of the things that struck me was how many people talked about how damaging it can be to be continually stared at. I know Andy Jackson's talked about this on the drama on ABC TV, and, you know, have people having their body studied in medical settings. Can you tell us a bit more about what kind of impact that can have?
Yeah, I mean, the constant staring at people is really wearing. And Andy made a really great point that when he goes out, his body is stared at in a different way to when he's on stage reciting poetry. Andy's a brilliant poet. And I thought that was a really great observation that he made, that now he, you know, since doing poetry, writing and performing poetry, he can choose how to be seen and reclaim that, like you mentioned with Olivia, reclaiming her personal space as well. I know that there were some other pieces in the book that talked about that medical observation, Andy's and Elle's, and while I didn't talk much about myself in the intro, I've certainly been stared at a lot by strangers and also by doctors.
That was a really powerful moment for me in your intro, Carly, where you said, you know, I got to this stage where I said, I don't want that to happen anymore. How difficult was that to do for you, to just draw a line?
I think, well, I mean, I, as people who know me and my writing and my social media presence would suspect, I've always been quite outspoken. And it was when I was sort of about 15 as a teenager in the middle of puberty, and I was at a hospital clinic, one of these conferences where maybe, I don't know, 200 doctors were there. And it was always pitched that this will be, you know, research for the future. This will help future patients. There will be a cure one day, like those sorts of words. And I was sitting there with a blanket and my underwear and one sock because they needed to look at one foot. And I was just freezing. It was so impersonal. The doctors weren't speaking to me. They were just speaking about me, conferring, and it was a really long day. And there's no payment in these either. You might get a nice box of chocolates and perhaps some hospital food brought to you. But I just couldn't see the benefit for me. And I understand that, you know, there needs to be some kind of altruism there where you're thinking about what might happen in the future. But when you're 15 and really self-conscious of your body and just stared at by a whole heap of people who make it so impersonal, it's hard. So I said to my mum that that's enough. I don't want to do it anymore. And I didn't.
That's
sometimes
fantastic.
I do, you know, allow medical students in when I'm in the clinic, at the dermatology clinic, but generally, you know, I'm really glad I have that option to say no.
It sounds like your mum was a really great support for you too. She said, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she absolutely was.
We're speaking with Carly Findlay, editor of Growing Up Disabled in Australia, and Olivia Musket, writer, critic and contributor to the anthology as well. Olivia, I noticed Graham Innes, the former Disability Discrimination Commissioner, talks about the soft bigotry, he calls it, of low expectations, how powerful it can be when people have this sense that, you know, you can't achieve beyond a certain level. Tell us about your drama teacher at school, because that went through a few ups and downs, didn't it?
That was a journey of ups and downs. And I think in that case, there were low expectations, but it was also this fear of my safety and what'll happen if something happens to me. And she, you know, I was 14, 13 years old, really excited to be involved in a school production. I was like, this is what I came to high school for, to sing and dance on stage. And I went up and I remember so clearly stepping into the drama room at school, and I'd barely gotten, you know, five steps in the door, and she came up to me and she said, oh, Olivia, you're not here to audition, are you? And I was just so squashed. I was crushed by that. And I think for a while that really got me down, but somehow I found the stubbornness to say, actually, no, I'm going to be involved in this. And I worked my butt off to prove that I could sing and dance and run around on stage as well as the next person. And, you know, even after this whole production was over and I'd done, you know, done the whole thing, did everything anyone else could do, I still, after that, the next year, I was like, actually, I don't want to put myself through that again. I don't want to prove you know, that I'm just as capable of doing the thing I love doing as everybody else. And somehow things changed at some point when I was about 16 and another musical came around, and I thought, no, I'm not going to miss out just because people think I shouldn't be there or it's too difficult. And I auditioned and I sang my little heart out and I proved I was capable of spinning around a room and doing the dance audition, and I was cast in a lead role, and honestly, I think that was the proudest moment of my life at that point. I was so excited. And then every year after that, well, through that production, we made tiny adjustments to make sure that I could play the role completely, fully. And when people would come up to me afterwards and say, oh, like, you're, well, they, no one really ever said this to my face, but they said it to other people, oh, she's blind, like, what? And it wasn't that I was ashamed of being blind or I didn't want to be seen as blind, but at that point, well, there was no blind role in, there was no role for a blind person. So I was playing a sighted character and I pulled it off. And I was, that was just, yes, we did it. And it was the tiniest little things about moving around the stage and that were accomplished so easily with some a bit of, you know, imagination and creativity. And then every year after that, I had a lead role and that was my favourite bit of high school.
Excellent. Well, those tiny adjustments are really interesting because Carly Findlay, they relate to what's called the social model of disability, don't they? The, this discussion about what needs to change, who needs to adapt so that people can fully participate in their communities. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so, I mean, the medical model of disability suggests that our bodies are broken and need to be fixed, which they aren't. And the social model of disability says that society is the disabling factor rather than our bodies being the only disabling factor. Of course, there might be things that our bodies can't do and we know our own limits, many of us do. But if these barriers are removed, like, you know, installing an accessible entrance or a lift in a building or, you know, getting a Auslan interpreter at an event so deaf people can know what's being said. Those are some ways to lift the barriers. So it's, I mean, I think it's really important to think of disability in that way rather than seeing our bodies as failures or things to be fixed.
Because it really relies on an assumption about what a quote-unquote normal body is, doesn't it? What happens when people are forced to examine that assumption?
Yeah, I think that when these accessibility provisions are made, it benefits so many more people than just disabled people. You know, a ramp will benefit someone who is elderly and uses a walker or a, you know, a parent and a pram. Captions, you know, on a video help people who are travelling on public transport who don't want to, you know, everyone, the whole carriage, to know what's being said on the video. I think that it needs to be thought beyond the disabled body and benefiting the whole of society as well.
I'm glad we dodged that freight train in the background too, though. That's very lucky.
Sorry. I think you've also got my husband whistling in the shower as well. We're in lockdown here, so he's home as well.
That's been one of the unexpected joys of talking to people in lockdown is hearing the kids and dogs and chickens and whistling husbands in the background. We're speaking with Carly Findlay, editor of Growing Up Disabled in Australia and obviously married well as well. Olivia Musket, writer, critic and contributor to Growing Up Disabled in Australia. Olivia, I found it really interesting that you wrote one of your letters to the Word Police, you said, who balk when you describe yourself as totally blind. Why do you think that's such a stumbling block for people?
I have thought about this a lot and I'm still not entirely sure, but I think, honestly, I think it comes from a place of fear. And I've thought about this a lot and there's something about seeing that really gets people. And the fact that, you know, all these expressions like seeing is believing and seeing is knowing, and I think they're so deeply embedded. People just can't imagine life without sight, and maybe they can imagine life with limited sight. You know, so many people wear glasses and all sorts, but the fact of totally of nothing, I think that just completely stumps people. It really accesses this place of complete terror. So the fact that I'm going around, you know, quite happily calling myself totally blind, you know, I can't see anything, that they can't bring themselves to say that. Like, what, you can't say that about yourself? I'm like, well, I can because it's true, and it doesn't make me any less for wanting to describe that myself that way or being that way.
Indeed, and that's a real theme that runs through the book, this constantly having to point out to people that you're not anything less than people with so-called able bodies. It was a fascinating read, from the really powerful stories from people like Elle Gibbs to the very funny and also powerful stories from people like Kit Kavanagh-Ryan coming out to her mum, and her mum saying, "You can't be disabled and a lesbian. Why would you do that to yourself?" Really wonderful writing in it too. It's been a pleasure chatting to you both today. Thank you so much for appearing on Life Matters.
Thank you so much.
Carly Findlay, editor of Growing Up Disabled in Australia, and Olivia Muscat, a writer, critic, and one of the many contributors to an incredibly diverse anthology